The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dongshan's Jewel Mirror Samadhi poem. Part 3. Just as in the ordinary infant, the five characteristics are complete. No coming, no going, no rising, no abiding, baba wawa, speaking without speaking. In the end, you cannot get the substance of it because the words are still not correct. In the six lines of the doubled Li hexagram, phenomena and the real interact. Piled up to become three, each transformed makes five. Like the taste of five-colored churgrass, like the five-pronged vajra. Secretly held within the real, rhythm and song arise together. So I've been drawing upon this poem, very well-known poem within the Zen tradition. Master Dongshan, who's a very important teacher in the Zen tradition, particularly in our lineage. And this poem is pointing to what so much of Mahayana teachings are pointing to, which is the unity of all things, that all things based in emptiness, in no fixedness, no self-existing, inherent, intrinsic, permanent essence, that all things arise from this nature. And arising from this nature, they're non-dual. And so that the whole world, in and of itself, is at peace. The whole world, in and of itself, is without conflict. And we, too, are just this way. But because of our human consciousness, our mind, our thinking, the meaning that we impute into the words that we use, our ability to create in our mind, to fantasize, to create worlds that don't exist in the future, or to remember worlds in the past that no longer exist and that don't exist in our mind in the way that they did in the moment. All of that very powerful functioning of our consciousness, when unexamined, when not known intimately, it's like having tremendous power and not knowing the power that we have. You know, I keep thinking of our time as a time in which, because of that, our consciousness, because of the evolution of humankind into the industrial age, the information age, into technology, that we are pretty good at creating things that have never existed before. I've talked to people who have come here who've been involved in research in artificial intelligence, for instance, and asked them, in your studies, in your work together, on your teams, do you talk about morality? Do you talk about ethics? Do you ever discuss whether this thing that you're creating needs to be created? Do we need this? What are the implications of this? Do you talk about those things? And it's all too often, it seems, and from my very limited surveys, all too often, it's not. It's just the thrill, the excitement of the possibility of something, right, that is actually acknowledged, right? No, it's like that takes over. Can we do this? Let's do it. And so that the power of our ability to imagine something and then bring it into creation, and then that's not enough, so it has to be launched. It gets brought into the world, into people's lives, without a vote, without asking. And whether we use it or not, it becomes part of our lives. being part of our lives, it becomes part of our evolution. We evolve to our environment. And so it's like that capacity to do all of that seems to have so outpaced our understanding. Who are we? What does it mean to be a human being? What are the most important things? What should we be applying our attention to? How do we live together? Right? These questions that have been around as long as there have been more than one person, which it seems was pretty much from the start. That we haven't quite worked out. Not in an embodied way, not in a far-reaching way. And now here we are sitting on the edge of the roof, as Rumi said, quite drunk with our power. And it's time to awaken. And so in this poem, as so much of the teachings are expressing, is how do we live in this state that we are, in our basic nature, and at last be it in harmony, in accord, in alignment, just not just with ourselves, but with everything. And as we see, it's not a small thing. It's not an easy thing, even though it's our essential nature. And so Dongshan opens with the Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. You have it. Keep it well. Now he's in part talking about having received, having realized, having been enlightened to this Dharma of thusness, now having realized it, keep it well. But he's at the same time, I think, we need to hear this as talking to each of us because we do have it. Are we keeping it well? This Dharma of thusness, realized by the Buddha, the truth beyond words and meaning. And so the teaching, painted cakes do not satisfy hunger. Pointing at the moon is not the moon. But it's manifested without knowing. All phenomena are free of duality. And so in that, from that understanding, painted cakes do satisfy hunger. Words and ideas are not the problem. We should not practice going to war against our mind or our thoughts or our emotions or anything. That's what we're trying to liberate ourselves from, is that path, the path of conflict, the path of war, the path of domination. Dogen, in his fascicle on the reality of all things, says the actualization of Buddhas and ancestors, embodying this, actualizing this, keeping it well, is the real form of exhaustive investigation, which is a very succinct way of really describing the path of Buddha Dharma. Real form is all phenomena. It's everything. It's not absent anywhere. All phenomena are the forms of suchness, are the nature of suchness, are the body of suchness, are the mind of suchness, the world of suchness, are the clouds and rain of suchness, are walking, standing, sitting, and lying down suchness, are the sorrow and joy, the excitement and calm suchness, the staff and whisk suchness. He's basically giving us an inventory of the world. Everything, anything, is endowed with this Dharma of thusness. Everything has it. And most things outside of the human realm do keep it quite well. And in that way can be radiant examples to us. We struggle, and so we practice. We raise bodhicitta. We study the teachings. We put those into practice in our body and mind. We encounter all phenomena arising in front of us. Things that we like, things that we don't like. things that we identify as I am and things we identify as I am not. We see, we possess, we reject. All of the stuff of the world arises in one moment after another within the universe of this human form. And now we have the opportunity to investigate, to examine with a clear eye, with a clearing eye. We begin to understand how to bring ourselves into right relationship with this body, with energy, with a posture, with a thought, with a memory, with an emotion, with a person, with a bowl of oatmeal, with a task, with a crisis, with dying. The actualization of Buddha's ancestors is the real form of exhaustive investigation. And so we, as the Buddha taught, we have to bring that element, this investigation, prajna. In order to do that, we have to have a reasonably clear field. Right? It's like when you want to do some subtle work on your desk and your desk is cluttered, right? You need to clear the desk. Make a good working space in which to do this examination. And so we have to find some clearness, some openness, some space within our minds. And so we practice mindfulness, cultivating concentration. And because we enter into the work from a world that has created a model of approaching all things from the perspective of brokenness, of dividedness, of high and low, of inside and outside, of belonging and othering, and the war, every war is the path to peace, because we have all of that inside of us. We have to come to this work, we have to sit at that table peacefully, with compassion. And we don't, right? There are moments, but there are other moments that in which that model of attack or aggress or retreat comes forth. And so we have to learn, how do we actually lay down our weapons, our arms? How do we open our hearts? Bodhidharma said, if the mind has something to value, then it will surely have something to despise. If it has something to affirm, it must have something to negate. If it takes one thing to be good, there will be other things that are not good. If there's affection for one person, there will certainly be grudges against others. And so we bring this real form of exhaustive investigation to exactly this, all of these dualities. And all the while we are sitting within this body of Buddha nature, this body of the Buddha, this body of perfection, this body of completeness, as we walk, as we eat, as we work, as we chant. And so Dongshan invokes the ordinary infant with five characteristics, the senses, that are complete. And that arriving into this world, they arrive in this state. No coming or going, no arising, no abiding, not created, not destroyed, selfless, free, liberated from the beginning. Baba Wawa. I can't hear that, and I think Barbara Walters. Do you hear that? He's invoking just the babbling of the baby, right? Just making sounds. Ba, 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 ma, 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 ma. Speaking, but he's invoking that for a reason. Speaking without speaking. Each is born with this body and mind of a Buddha. The five senses are present if we're born with those intact. We are alive, we are aware. There is inside and outside, but the infant is not enlightened to this. She has desire. She cries when she's hungry. When she's wet, when she's not happy, when she becomes satisfied, she tends to go to sleep. And yet in every moment from the beginning, she and her world are perfect forms of suchness. Dada Roshi, I was remembering, he used to often tell the story of the ugly duckling. Many of you will remember. The duck who, through some accident, came to be amongst a group of swans. No, was it the other way? Swan in the group of ducks, right? Thus, ugly duckling, right? So she was perfect and complete. She was a swan through and through. But believing herself to be a duck in the family of ducks, she stood out. She didn't belong. She thought herself inadequate. And even though she tried in every way to be like the ducks, to walk, to quack, she never quite measured up. And so always this sense of somehow being outside, at odds, incomplete, something lacking, always reaching for something, some way to finally be in harmony, until finally she comes across a family of swans and realizes, oh, from the beginning, I was just this. And so in the baby's sounds, before there's words and meaning, just the seeds of what will become words and ideas, these sounds come forth naturally. And in her not knowing, in her not understanding, not being entangled in any meaning, there is no right and wrong. There's no high and low. There's no comparison of this sound with another. So is she enlightened? Well, she seems unhappy when she doesn't get what she wants. In the end, Dongshan says, you can't get to the substance of this way, because words, he says, are still not correct. They cannot, they themselves cannot free us. They don't have that power. They don't have any intrinsic power. But they're also not the enemy. They don't bind us. They don't entangle us. They don't have that power either. When we liberate them, our idea of them, from having that power, then we see how powerful they are and how we can use them as practitioners. That's what Dongshan is trying to do, is use the words and meaning to help us. And yet this infant, with all of this complete, is not yet ready to take up her exhaustive investigation. It's not time yet for that. She has other work to do, which is, in a sense, to become deluded, to create a sense of self, to flesh that out, identities, to be in her world, to try and make sense of it, to find her place in it, to fill her world, inner and outer, with meaning. And then, being a human being, having a human life, to experience the pain and suffering in this world, and hopefully to open that eye and begin to wonder, hang on, there's more, there has to be more. Master Sheng Yen says about this, Buddhist teachers are much like babies, making nonsense sounds trying to speak. They know what they've experienced, they know what they want to say, but there's no way they can actually say it. They cannot actually convey it fully. Sometimes it's spoken of as the family shame. And so we use poetry. In the early periods of Zen, there were experiments with sounds and strikes and gestures and using symbols and all kinds of way to try and go beyond words and language. Dongshan says, in the six lines of the doubled Li hexagram, phenomena and real interact, piled up to become three, each transformed makes five. So he's really drawing upon the I Ching and the use of these hexagrams and the meaning contained therein. And Master Sheng Yin sort of relates those to a circle, and a circle that in different levels, it really corresponds with Dungshan's teachings on the five levels or stages of absolute and relative, or the phenomenal and the real, which is really just a somewhat complicated way and a conceptual way of trying to speak about and illuminate and bring understanding and exhaustive investigation to this. This world and everything in it that arises out of what we call the real, what we call the ultimate, what we describe as emptiness, free, utterly. Because there's not a thing in it, not a thing outside of it. There is no possibility of conflict. There is no possibility of flaw. There is not a single thing. And the relative world, the phenomenal world, the world of things and concepts and ideas, the world we live in, to find our place where we already are. And so he uses these symbols and light and dark to indicate how through practice we begin in our, as he speaks of it, our vexations, our karmic formations, our kleshas, our emotions, our entanglements, our attachments, and how that seems to sort of consume us. But then as we gain insight, it's as though there is some light that appears, some understanding, the window begins to open. But those attachments and views and those kleshas are still there. They still have power. And so there is this ongoing kind of relationship between these two aspects, moving forward, leaping forward, and then being, in a sense, being pulled back into old habits and old patterns. And then how that continues to evolve and transform. So those patterns become more gentle, less threatening, less powerful, less something. And so it's as though there's more and more light that is coming through. But those fixations, those attachments, they still have strength. The Buddha said, we speak of them as underlying dispositions, strong underlying inclinations that appear. They appear the same and they appear differently. They're not the same. They're not as strong. We see them more clearly. And ultimately, through all of these, this particular teaching, through all of these various stages, we come to unity attained, where we realize that it is all just one nature, that there is no inherent conflict, that thoughts and ideas are not binding in and of themselves. They may be skillful and unskillful, yes. And that ultimately we find peace, that it's been here all along, that nothing is to be extinguished or eradicated. And so that whole notion of the, finding the enemy and destroying the enemy, extinguishing the enemy, sequestering the enemy, othering the enemy, we realize is nothing more than going to war against ourselves. That's why the victor in every battle is the loser. As well. Bodhidharma said, mind does not abide in forms. It does not abide in formlessness. It does not abide in abiding. It does not abide in not abiding. If mind has abiding, it will not avoid being roped in if it abides anywhere, if it rests anywhere. If it solidifies anything, then it will be roped in. If mind has a place where it functions, then it will find itself in bondage. If mind values the Dharma, then the Dharma will ultimately, eventually hold you back. And so that's the exhaustive investigation of at every moment, because probably most of us secretly think, I'm up for non-attachment, right? I'm up for letting go. I'm all about that. And I'm going to get to a point where I'm going to have secreted away. You know, it's like coming to session and like I've got a little like some fruit bars and some cookies, you know, in my sleeve. And it's like I've got a few little, you know, things just to keep me happy. And so we think, yeah, I'm good for letting go of all the stuff that binds me and that's troublesome. Yeah, I'm all about that. But, you know, I'm going to be able to hold on to a few things, a few little secret things, a few little precious things. They don't weigh much. They don't take up much room. And what Bodhidharma is saying is, you know, actually, they do. They do have weight. They do rope us in. They will hold us back. We'll see. Don't believe? Okay, we'll see. Check it out. Examine. And the very idea of letting go and what that means, why do we think that we need to keep preserving? What do we think letting go is part of what has to be liberated. Today we did a memorial for the venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, who was one of the great beings in our lifetime, who grew up in war, in a great deal of pain and suffering, and then devoted his whole life to this path of peace. And I wanted to bring him into this talk, and I went naturally, easily to his poem he's most well known for, Please Call Me By My True Names. And I remembered or saw again how it's such a perfect expression of what Dungshan is teaching, of what this poem, which can get a little complicated because he's drawing upon some sophisticated concepts, right, to try and communicate something that is not so easy to understand. It's not. We do have to spend time and study and examine and then bring into our practice and see that what these teachings are talking about is right here. It's not abstract. When we get entangled, that's what we're getting entangled in. In the thingness of things, in the duality of things. That when we release ourselves from that, when there is a moment of light coming through the window, when there is a shift, that is an encounter with the real. It doesn't mean it's realized, but we're encountering that because the nature of whatever was binding us is empty. If it weren't, then we would be forever and irrevocably, intractably bound. No one would have ever been enlightened. No one would have ever been liberated. And so he says in his poem, don't say that I will depart tomorrow. Even today I am still arriving. Look deeply. Every second I'm arriving. To be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with still fragile wings, learning to sing in my new nest. To be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. And we can hear those words and think, oh yes, that's the world that I want to live in. It is so tender, it is so sweet, it is so beautiful. And so that we don't misunderstand his words, so that we don't turn that beauty, that sweetness, into another entanglement. He continues and says, I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that is alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird that swoops down to swallow the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am the grass snake that silently feeds itself on the frog. And even still, we can think, yes, but that's nature's way. There's still beauty in that. Life feeds on life. I understand that. It is still safe, and it is still distant, and it is still not me. And so he continues, I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. And I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands. And I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people dying slowly in a forced labor camp. I came across the story that he told about this poem, and he said that after the war, the Vietnam War, when so many people were fleeing for their lives from Vietnam, that they were receiving, Asanga was receiving hundreds and hundreds of letters, and he said it was so painful to read them, but we had to. We had to be in contact. We tried our best to help, but the suffering was enormous, and sometimes we were discouraged. Even a great living bodhisattva has moments of discouragement and despair and hopelessness. He said, there were many young girls, boat people, who were raped by sea pirates. Even though the United Nations and many countries tried to help the government of Thailand prevent that kind of piracy, sea pirates continued to inflict much suffering on the refugees. One day we received a letter telling us about a young girl on a boat who was raped by a Thai pirate. She was only 12, and she jumped into the ocean and drowned herself. And then he said, when you first learn of something like that, you get angry at the pirate. You naturally take the side of the girl. As you look more deeply, though, you will see it differently. If you take the side of the little girl, then it's easy. You only have to take a gun and shoot the pirate. It's solved. That evil has been addressed. That wrong has been righted. The score has been settled. Eye for an eye. But he says, but we can't do that. That is the spiritual imperative of the Buddha Dharma. If we want to put an end to suffering, we have to stop creating it. And so he said, in my meditation, I saw that if I had been born in the village of the pirate and raised in those same conditions as he was, I would now be the pirate. There's a great likelihood that I would become a pirate. I can't condemn myself then so easily. In my meditation, I saw that many babies are being born along the Gulf of Siam, hundreds every day. And if we educators, social workers, politicians, and others do not do something about this situation, in 25 years, a number of them will become sea pirates. It's certain. If you or I were born today in those same fishing villages, we would become sea pirates in 25 years. If you take a gun and shoot the pirate, you have to shoot all of us. Because all of us are to some extent responsible for the state of affairs. And so he said, after a long meditation, I wrote this poem. In it, there are three people. The 12-year-old girl, the pirate, and me. Can we look at each other and recognize ourselves in each other? The title of the poem is Please Call Me by My True Names, because I have so many names. And when I hear one of these names, I have to say, yes. I have to respond knowing that my name has been called. I think there is no greater challenge in this human life than this, to live this. Seeing so much harm, so much evil, seeing people who are so consciously, intelligently, with great determination, with tireless effort, dedicated to bringing harm into the world. Sometimes people think that when we chant all evil karma ever created by me since of old, that that is too strong. Is it? And as he says, it's just so easy to want to solve the problem by just picking up a gun and just shooting somebody. Just end them. Make them just go away. Stop this. But so what do we do when something needs to be stopped? When someone needs to be stopped? Well, when they're on the other side of the fence, in fact, the further away they get, the easier it is, right? And so now we kill by drones. Imagine somebody sitting in an office, in a room, a windowless room somewhere, Nebraska, Kansas, Idaho. It's just a 9-to-5 job. Just go and sit down at a keyboard and manipulate the keys, look at a screen, press a button, people will die. That remove that we have now created, engineered at such a level of unimaginability, right? As though that removes our responsibility, removes our killing. And the fact is, we don't actually need physical space to create that remove. Lord knows we remove ourselves at a distance from ourselves. That's how powerful our mind is. And so that's why so many wise people throughout the ages of all traditions have said an unexamined mind is actually a very dangerous thing. To have that much power and to not know. To be governed by forces of greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy, fear, and not know those either. Not understand. What makes this poem so powerful is it's so simple. It brings us right to the point. It puts us right on the spot. And he does this with the greatest of compassion. And he puts himself at the center. He is the one who wants to pick up the gun and shoot. I am the one who wants to end this. And how easily we can slip into that. And as he says, but we cannot. We have a path, we take vows. We take vows to bind us to the truths that we are dedicated to examining and living. And we bind ourselves to those truths for those very moments when the easiest thing to do were just to be what has been done before. And so to hold ourselves. Right? Yesterday we spent a day looking at this path of compassion, at the precepts, at the paramitas, at all of these teachings, all of these practices, all of these ways of holding us to that which we must do, as the Buddha often said. and to free ourselves of those things that we cannot do. We can, but we must not. And when we do, we must recover ourselves. We must find our way back. Somebody in the retreat yesterday spoke of their practice and their dedication to it, and yet the ways in which coming to a session or a retreat makes them leave home and their family, and it seems to create conflict, and you know, how do they decide? And that the family is clearly a priority, and they described their practice as a kind of luxury. And I said, I understand how it can seem that way. But I said, but I really urge you to look at it differently. Because things that are put into the category of luxury, they're the first things to go. Right? Because they're luxuries. We don't need them. They're nice. They make life better and more comfortable. But in times of direness, those are the things we leave behind. This is not that. This is not that. And this great bodhisattva is trying to help us understand how all of this comes together, that we are all implicated. Because it's our nature. Implication is just another way of saying, it's us, it's me. When you call a name, all of us should at the same time say yes. I remember once years ago, I was in a store with my mother, and I think my sister, we were somewhere up in New England, and we were just looking for gifts and things. And the store is quite full. And at one point I saw something, and I thought, oh, and I said, Mom, and 20 women's heads turned towards me. It was pretty cool. And their children weren't even there, right? But it's just like, somebody called my name. Wherever I am, I answer. So that's what this great, venerable bodhisattva is trying to convey to us. That when the call goes out, may we answer.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.